greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Czech story when we come back. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, your government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. And that's because everything that government, industry, or business knows about any of us is because we told them. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects us in our persons, houses, papers, and effects, but it doesn't protect us from ourselves. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. Information about us is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and very logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how much information is gathered and what information is stored and what information that you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you and I into the driver's seat in our quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you have not revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour program. It's entertaining. It's informative. It's educational. And best of all, it's free of charge. And you can just call the school at area code 417-273-4967 to order yours. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Czechs, C-H-E-C-K. It's also spelled C-H-E-Q-U-E. Czech. Everybody uses them. Everybody has them. They're about as common as pig tracks on a hog farm. But they're fairly recent. In American history, up until 1950, the average Joe Sixpack American did not use Czechs. It isn't that Czechs weren't known. Czechs have been around for thousands of years. It's actually a warehouse receipt. There's a story that we'll talk about with warehouse receipts and how those work. And then there's a C-H-E-Q-U-E, and then there's a C-H-E-C-K. Most people use the C-H-E-C-Ks. About 1950, Bank of America out in California came up with what they called the 10-plan checking program. It was for Sally Soccer Moms and Joe Sixpacks, who up until 1950 were either getting a pay check from their company or, more commonly, a pay envelope. In fact, even the employers weren't using checks to pay their employees. I remember my Uncle Lyle working at Pacific Lumber Company described how they got a pay envelope every 2 weeks. You walked up and you said, well, my name is Lyle Stanley, and they'd flip through the envelopes, and then inside the envelope there would be $20 bills or $10 bills or $1 bills, and then maybe some change, 85 cents in change, and they'd pay you to the penny, but they paid you in cash and currency. Prior to that, when you got paid in gold and silver coin. And then, after June 5th, 1933, a very pivotal day in the history of the United States, we began to see that our gold coin was taken away from us. And then after the gold coin disappeared, we saw more cash and currency, that is, silver coin, but more Federal Reserve notes. And then we began to see checks, about 1950. payrolls were made up with checks, and people had to pay income tax. That began in 1942, I believe it was, with the Victory Tax Act. And then it became something new and novel for Joe Sixpack to join the club, and he too could be a businessman. I mean, he's working for wages, pulling lumber on the green chain, but now he's going to get a paycheck that he's going to deposit in the bank, and then he's going to write checks and pay such things as the electric bill, the telephone bill, maybe the house payment, mortgage. And he would have a record of that 10 plant. It was 10 cents a check. 10 cents a check. And you got 10 checks. Well, you know, the average guy didn't have 10 bills. He'd pay the phone bill, and he'd pay the power bill, and he'd pay the mortgage. And, you know, he was writing 30, 40, 50 cents worth of checks a month. But they told us that, well, it keeps a perfect record of your expenses so that when you make out your income tax, you'll have your checks, and it'll be a simple matter for you to simply go through your checks and take all your deductions so that you get everything that's coming to you. This made all the sense in the world. It was just that logical. By 1960, in just 10 years' time, I don't believe I knew anybody that didn't have a checking account. And, of course, the old Bank of America 10 plan, it went by the boards in 3 or 4 or 5 years, and there were other checking plans from other banks. It was very competitive. And then they started offering things like, gee, free checking. See, we won't charge you 10 cents a check if you keep a minimum balance. So if you kept $100 in the bank all the time, well, they would do your checking free. You were writing 10 or 15 checks a month, and for that buck and a half, you know, they were getting very cheap interest. I mean, think of it. You keep $100 in your account, you write 15 checks at 10 cents a check, you know, it's a buck and a half, and the bank gets the use of your money, you know. And so it was good for the bank, and it was good for you, and everybody prospered. Today, everybody uses checks. And these checks are kind of peculiar. They're maritime contracts is what they are. It's the highest and most sophisticated form of maritime contract so far developed by the mind of man. Unless, of course, you want to get into computers. Now, maybe the computer system with direct deposits and automatic payment plans are a little more sophisticated than the check. But the check is a maritime contract, and it has great legal significance for you. Great legal significance. Now, some years back, 1983, I believe, was the year I was delivering a series of lectures in a school in Duncan, Oklahoma, at the Heritage Library. And there was an old man there by the name of A.J. Porth. Now, A.J. Porth was probably the beginning of the modern tax protest movement in America. The very first tax protester mentioned in history is a fellow by the name of Gideon. He's mentioned in the book of Judges in the Bible. And he lived around 12 to 1300, you know, move it up a little bit, maybe 1150 to 1250 B.C. Very first tax protester. And in the modern era, you know, tax protesting has been going on, tax evasion, you know, avoiding or evading the taxes set down by the king, you know, has been going on for thousands of years. It started probably about 1 Samuel chapter 8. But here's a tax protester, and a little bit earlier than that, the Israelites were under Midian control at that time. They were in a foreign occupation, kind of like America occupying Iraq. And so the Americans impose upon the Iraqis American ideas and American values and American taxes. And then, of course, the Iraqis will get American gun control and American 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and they'll get all of the neat things that democracy has to offer, income tax and gun control just being two of them. So anyway, this guy Gideon was hiding his grain from the Midianites so that he didn't have to pay taxes on. And this fellow, A.J. Porth, was a tax protester, and he had been to prison. He was an old man in his 80s. And I just delivered a lecture, and when I got through, I was walking away from the podium, and Mr. Porth caught me in the hallway, and he said, Mr. Gordon, that was a very interesting talk you just gave. And I said, well, thank you very much, Mr. Porth. And he said, would you like me to explain checks to you? Not taxes, but explain checks. Now, at this time, 1983, I was 44 years old. I had been operating several businesses. I was a general contractor, a plumbing contractor, a boiler and sheet metal contractor, and I had had a payroll of as high as 30 people and 7 service trucks. I thought that I knew just about everything there was to know about checks. I mean, what more could you know? You know, you go down to the bank and you sign an agreement and you get a little book and it's got some checks in it. You take it home, you fill them out, you pass them around, and you know, you get a statement from the bank every month, and you reconcile your checkbook, and you make your deposits, and you write your checks, and you pay your bills, and what more is there to know? Well, Porth at that time was 83 years old. Now, this is 1983. He's 83 years old, born around the turn of the century. He had all of his hair, and it was just snow white hair. And there's a biblical instruction in the book of Proverbs. It says, rise up before the hoary head. And so here was this old man with gray hair, and he said to me, would you like me to explain checks to you? And my initial reaction was, listen, you old man, I really don't need to listen to you. I've got other things I want to do, and no, I don't. But I remembered that old proverb, and I didn't have anything else going on anyway. And A.J. Porth was kind of a celebrity in tax protest circles, although I've been accused of being a tax protester a time or two, but that's not true. Don't you believe that for a minute. I'm not protesting any tax. I think we need the income tax, especially here in America. And I'm not trying to free the slaves, because if you freed all of the slaves, who would do the work? So don't think that I'm out here trying to free everybody from the income tax or the Federal Reserve System or the IRS or the Social Security people at all. That's not the bottom line. But getting back to Mr. Porth, I said, well, Mr. Porth, I would be honored if you would take your time to explain to me what you know about checks. And Porth said, well, come into my office and sit down. We went in the office and sat down. I was in there for about 3 hours. And then when I came out, I've never been the same since. Now, you need to remember that I just learned to count, you know, a few years before that. I was 37 when I learned how to count. And I was 43 when I learned what checks were all about. Now, you need to understand that I was handicapped from an early age. You see, I was born mentally retarded. And I was institutionalized when I was age 6. It's pretty obvious that I was mentally retarded, and that's why they had to institutionalize me in the public school system. So for 12 years, I was institutionalized in the public school system, and when I came out of the public school system in 1957, I was just as dumb as a box of rocks. Absolutely stupid. And I believed all kinds of things that had been funneled into my brain while I had been institutionalized during this period of mental retardation. However, beginning in 1957, when I got loose, when I got out of the institution, I found out that there was indeed knowledge independent of the school system. You see, up until 1957, I didn't think that there was any knowledge available from anybody outside of the school system with paid professionals who had been to college and had teaching credentials and were very smart people with letters after their names who told me that they were very smart people and had letters after their names, and that if I wanted to be a very smart people, that I needed to go to college and that I needed to continue my institutionalization for the rest of my life. But at age 18, I thought, gee, instead of institutionalization, what would it be like out in the real world if I were free? So I didn't go to college. Stayed out. And I didn't go into the military. And I stayed out. And instead I went to work, and in my work and in my labors and in the people that I met while I was working and laboring, I found out that there was indeed much knowledge and much wisdom out there that was totally independent of academics. But you need to understand that I was strongly influenced by those academics. Now, to give you an illustration, I was told early on when I was a kid by my Uncle Lyle, never trust the banks and never put your money in the bank. Now, he had lived through the 1930s, 1920s. He was born in 1898 or 99. And he'd lived through that. He knew what gold and silver coin was, and he knew what checks were, and he had lived through this period of time. And this is the tragedy of human beings. You see, by the time we get to where we know something, we die. And young people aren't about to learn anything from the old people that are about to die. I mean, that's not American. We're not going to do that. Young people want to learn from other young people who don't have any experience, but have a lot of book learning. And the more book learning you have, the smarter you are, because book learning produces degrees. Degrees have letters, and these letters are posted after your name, and people are very vain, and they like to have these letters after their name because it says, I'm very smart. And I'm not denying that. And they probably have a lot of knowledge. And they probably have a lot of information that they've memorized and put between their ears. But then when it comes to using that information, we find out that it doesn't work. You know, you can just take a look at the peace process going on in the Middle East. The people who are engaged in the peace process, you know, people like Condoleezza Rice and George Bush and Tony Blair and the al-Fatah people and the Hezbollah people, all these people, you know, been to college. They're not dummies. You don't get to be Secretary of State because you're stupid. You don't get to be President of the United States, you know, because you can't add and subtract. So these are very bright people. But there's no peace, as I pointed out to you the other day. I said, look, these people don't know the way of peace, or we'd have a whole lot more of it. Now, the same thing is true here when we talk about money and checks and banking and et cetera. These people that are giving us these checks, they're not dumb people. You know, you don't get to be president of Bank of America because you're mentally retarded. No, like people like me. Not at all. These people aren't mentally retarded. They may have been institutionalized, but they're pretty bright guys, and they're the best and the brightest, and they come up with novel new ideas with which to take our wealth away from us. And so us little guys, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Soccer Moms, are out here working hard, producing a bunch. And then the Ken Lays of the world, you know, come along and they take it away from us. Like Ken Lay, you know, he had 36,000 people working at Enron, and he did well. And he sold his stock before the stock went down. He used insider trading, and he used his knowledge of what was going on to enrich himself at the expense of the little guys that were working for him. And one day, all the little guys, the Joe Sixpacks, they found out the company's bankrupt, it's upside down, and they lost everything, or they lost a bunch. Okay, well, who were the dummies? Ken Lay? Or was it the people that trusted Ken Lay and the people with the letters after their names? And the people that are dying over in Vietnam, you know, are they the dummies, or is it the Halliburtons and Bechtels and Bushes and Cheneys who are the smart guys? You know, I'll leave it to you. You decide for yourself. But it seems like to me that getting killed or your legs blown off by roadside bombs in the interests of furthering corporate enterprise like Halliburton, Bechtel, and Enron and Exxon and Mobil and so on, it seems like to me to be counterproductive to us little guys down here at the bottom. Which brings us to this A.J. Porth, who had the same mindset. Now, A.J. Porth, an old man at the time I met him, had worked through World War II at the Kaiser Shipyard in Richmond, California, and he was a business agent for a laborers' union in the shipyard building those Liberty ships. In 1942, Congress enacted the Victory Tax Act. And if you'll remember your history, In 1935, Congress enacted the Social Security Act. From 1935 to 1942, the Social Security Act was sold to us as an annuity, an insurance plan. It was a plan that Arthur Altmaier, who was the first commissioner of Social Security, went out on the stump and he sold, like George Bush went out on the stump trying to sell his Social Security program. Well, Arthur Altmaier was more successful, and he sold a Social Security program to the people based upon the concept and the principles of insurance, which was a lie. Social Security is not insurance, and the Supreme Court's told us that several times. It's a social welfare scheme. That's what the Supreme Court called it in Halvering versus U.S. back in 1959. A social welfare scheme. More about that later. But the moral to the story is, Social Security was up and running for 7 years, and then all of a sudden, here comes the Victory Tax Act. Now, the Constitution of the United States provides for a taxing mechanism for 2 years during time of war. When you're involved in a war, the United States can come out and create a direct tax. Just come out and tax you for the cost of the war. And that's what they did in 1942. This came to us and they said, okay, we're going to enact a war tax here. We've got to have more money. And we're going to call this the Victory Tax Act. And we're going to just tax everybody in the country so that everybody has a little stake in this war, making the world safe for democracy from Tojo and Adolf Hitler. And so they enacted the tax. It wasn't very much. And that wasn't the important part of the Victory Tax Act. There was a provision added to it which was called the withholding provision. And that's because businesses are made up of smart people that go to college, and green chains and lumber yards and woods people and truck drivers, they're all dumb people, you know. They're not sophisticated, don't have a lot of letters. And so they needed a guardian to figure out how much tax they owed and then take it out of their paycheck every week or two or once a month. And then pay that over to the government. That's called the withholding provision. And then at the end of the year, when they'd taken too much, and you'll notice they never take too little, they always take more than they're entitled to, then you get this refund check. Isn't that a lot of fun? You know, every year you file your income tax with H&R Block, and then you get this refund check. And then you can go down to White Front or Circle K or someplace, and you can go spend that extra money. What that is an interest-free loan to the government. And the way that works is if you were to underpay, the government would come in and charge you for that underpayment and charge you 10% interest. But when you overpay, the government pays you no interest at all. Isn't that just real special? You ever notice that? So if you underpay, they fine you 60% of the underpayment, plus 10% interest. If you overpay, they give you a refund check and then tell you what nice guys they are. I always thought that was real special. Well, A.J. Porth was watching this Victory Tax Act and watching the war, patriotic man that he was, and everything went fine. Remember, it only runs for 2 years. And so 2 years later, 1944, the tax expires. Congress repeals the Tax Act. But he noticed that in his next paycheck, the withholding continued. So he, being a labor union boss, he went over to management and he said, well, what's this? The Victory Tax Act has expired. Therefore, the tax has been taken off. So therefore, you got to quit taking it out of the paychecks of our workers over here. And the management said, you don't understand. You just go on back and do what you're doing real well and shut up. Well, Porth didn't think that was right. He said, now, wait a minute. 1942, they passed this two-year tax based upon this constitutional provision. 2 years has expired. The tax has expired, and you people are still taking the money out of these workers' paychecks. That's wrong. That's a crime. That's a theft. You got to stop. And so he got very loud and vociferous. Now, this is right, you know, in the middle of the war, 1944. And this is about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party. You got to keep in mind that there's nobody that wants to rock the boat. And the labor union says, wait a minute, we're getting $1.75 an hour. We're making good money. We got full employment. Everything's going great in Porthos over here. Rocking the boat. And the management, they're sitting over there saying, yeah, this guy Porth, he's over here rocking the boat. And it's getting to the point, well, they didn't call him a terrorist in those days, but they, you know, they'd call that a seditious act, or they'd say that's unpatriotic, or something else. So during wartime, you know, the party that's in power, you know, they point the finger at the other guys over there and they say, you guys ain't patriotic, you're not supporting the war. Well, Porth, being the kind of fellow that he was, he just kept making a lot of noise. And then the war ended, and he kept making more noise. And as time went on, he said, wait a minute, this is just plain wrong. Because this income tax and this withholding program over here expired in 1944, and they're continuing to do it. And so he told me that, and I wondered about that. And I said, gee, I didn't know that, because you see, in 1944, I was about 5 or 6 years old. And if I had a lifespan of 200 or 300 or 400 years, and I could remember when George Washington was president, you know, and Andrew Jackson, and I could remember the Civil War and World War I and World War II, see, I'd have a better understanding of history. I would have been reading the newspapers at that time, and my brain could remember that. But you see, I wasn't there in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, and I wasn't there when Andrew Jackson vetoed the United States National Bank Bill, and I wasn't there in the Civil War, and I wasn't there in World War I. So I have to rely upon history. I have to rely upon what people who lived at that time wrote down in books. And those people who write those things down in books and then pass them on to us when we go to school, we believe are telling us the truth. But has it ever occurred to you that maybe, just maybe, now, I don't want to stretch your mind too far here, just maybe, the people who wrote those books in 1940, 45, 50, might have given some bad information. Maybe they didn't lie intentionally, but maybe they lied inadvertently, or maybe they lied intentionally, or maybe they didn't tell too many intentional lies, but maybe they told a lot of truth and then just a little bit of lies, or maybe they told a lot of lies and a little bit of truth. You know, when you're going to school, you don't get paid for dissecting information to find out if it's true or false. You get paid for passing tests on Friday. Memorize the material and then regurgitate it back. School has very little to do with education. It has a lot to do with memorization. You memorize the material. You don't question the textbook. Nobody says, how do we know that this is true? And I read this other book over here written by this Confederate guy in Georgia. This is where I got my first introduction, by the way, to lying in textbooks. I read some books that were written by Southern generals from their perspective of the war. Then I read some other textbooks by Northern generals and got their perspective on the war, and I noticed that they didn't agree. They all agreed that the Battle of Gettysburg occurred in 1863, but they didn't all agree as to the cause. They didn't all agree to the facts that were going on. And sometimes we get told stories that we believe that just aren't true, you know, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. See? Now, textbooks are going to be written about this phase of history, and then little children in the year 2015 and 2050 and 2100 or 2200, they're going to be reading those stories just like we read the stories about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and the War of 1812 and so on. And we rely upon those historians to tell us the truth, and the plain fact of the matter is we don't always get the truth. All right, now, A.J. Porth, having lived through World War II when I was just a little toddler over there, actually knew more about what had gone on. And then when I got out of high school, my view of World War II and the Victory Tax Act and Social Security and many other of these social acts of the Roosevelt years were told to me in a different light than A.J. Porth told them to me in that 3-hour meeting. And so this left me in a quandary. Well, who's telling me the truth? Franklin D. Roosevelt or A.J. Porth? You know, at some point in time, you know, this comes up a lot of times with people. They listen to their preacher. And the preacher says things like Jesus nailed the law to the cross and so took it out of the way. And he explains Galatians and Ephesians from that point of view. And then maybe someday you pick up the Bible and maybe you're just kind of flipping through the pages. And you come to Matthew 5:17 and Jesus says, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law. I didn't come to destroy but to fulfill." And this leaves you in a quandary because who are you going to believe? You know, you're going to believe the preacher or that lying Jesus over here that didn't know what he was talking about and is dead now? You know, you have to make these kind of choices. That's the quandary that it puts you in. And so here I was this day listening to this old man with gray hair telling me the story about the Victory Tax Act and how it hadn't been removed in 1944. And I says, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, you would think that if it expired, you know, they'd quit taking the money out. So I tucked that one away in my heart, and I said, gee, I need to figure out why. What happened with the Victory Tax Act that they put it on for 2 years in 1942, and then you're still having this withholding in 2006? And they're not just taking a little bit, they're taking a whole bunch. And they're not just taking a little bit for Social Security, like 1%, now they're taking 16%. What happened? Hang on, we'll be back with more about the story of the check when we come back. Meanwhile, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling direct the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the check. Checks, C-H-E-C-K's. Common as big tracks, everybody's got a checking account. At least by the year 2006, everybody does. Well, everybody but me. I don't have one any longer. I used to have checking accounts. I'm pretty familiar with checks. I'm not, you know, a total virgin when it comes to writing checks or running corporations, hiring and firing people, doing business and writing contracts and things like that. And I started my first business in 1950 as a paper boy. learned how to make change and learned how to deliver papers and sell papers and one thing and another. And so I've had a very long and distinguished business career. Nothing big, you know, like Enron, but I've always made a profit, you know. And I've been able to meet my payroll, paid my taxes, you know. I always got my taxes paid. Except for once. It was one time I didn't get my taxes paid. But other than that, I've done pretty well at that. Now, A.J. Porth is over here, and he wants to tell me the story about checks. First of all, he explained to me about the Victory Tax Act and the withholding provision. He got into Social Security, and he said that was an abortion from day one, but we're stuck with it whether we like it or not. Now, while Social Security and the income tax in most people's minds are about as disconnected as AC and DC power, I want to tell you at this juncture of our story that Social Security and the income tax go together like a horse and carriage. They're inseparable. You can't have one without the other. Not under our Constitution. Not under our Title 26 taxing program. Social Security and the income tax go together like a horse and carriage. But A.J. Porth, at this juncture of our conversation, told me a story. He said, let me tell you the story of Joe the Barber. Joe the Barber. It was 1930, and Joe the Barber was operating his barber shop, making about $4.50 a day. Well, he'd make $4.50 in the morning, and then he'd quit for the rest of the day. If he worked for the whole day, he'd make $4.50 in the morning and $4.50 in the afternoon, and he could make as much as $9 a day, which was pretty good money for 1930, the Depression coming on us and all. So old Joe was doing his thing, working about a half a day, making $4.50. And all of a sudden, a very strange opportunity came to bear. He was doing his thing, and about 9 o'clock, Sam the banker came into the barber shop, and he said, Now, I've got a new job up in Chicago, and I need to look my best, and I've got to catch the 1 o'clock train. Now, I need a shave, a shampoo, a haircut, and a manicure. And I need all of that performed right now. Looking around in the barbershop, Joe could see that he had two or three customers. And he told Sam, he said, now, I've got these customers over here ahead of you. And Sam said, I will pay you $9. Now, that's as much as Sam was going to make all day cutting hair. And then he was going to get $9 this morning from Sam the banker. And if he worked this afternoon, he'd make another $4.50, which would be $13.50 for the day. Now, that's pretty big money in 1930. And so Joe the barber said to Sam the banker, you're on. So he ran over, got on the telephone, and he called his manicurist, and he called the hairdresser, and he went to work giving Sam the haircut and the shave, and pretty soon the manicurist came in, and then they did the hair, and they got him out of there about noon, and Sam the banker wrote a check to Joe the barber for $9, dated May 14th, 1930. So here's Joe the barber sitting here with a check now, and he doesn't have a checking account. So he gets to thinking about this, is, what am I going to do with this check? So he's got a pretty good idea. He says, well, I know that my barber supplier, the wholesale company that supplies me with my greasy kid stuff, the wild root cream oil, I know what I'll do. I'll give the $9 check to him in payment for my barber supplies. And sure enough, when Bill the supplier came in, Joe the barber endorsed the back of the check. You know, on the back of the check, you have to endorse it. You ever notice that? What does that mean? Why do you endorse the back of a check? What legal significance does that have? What's the purpose behind it? You ever wonder about that? If you look at the face of the check over here, it says pay to the order of. Go get your checkbook. Take a look at this thing and let's analyze this. Get your checkbook out there. And whip out a check over here. And, you know, up in the upper left-hand corner, it'll say Mr. and Mrs. Joe Sixpack. And it's got your name, address, and phone number, and half of you people have your Social Security number on there. Your taxpayer identification number, Social Security. Then over here on the right side, it says got a place for a date. Up in the upper right-hand corner, there's a check number, number 475. And then right underneath that check number, look at those funny numbers. Do you see that X40-54 with a slash or an underline? That's, and then underneath it says 1011. Do you see that? Well, it might not say 40-54, and there might not be an X with a 1011, but it's got some little numbers on there. And that's an important little number. And then it says pay to the order of, and then it's got a blank, and then it's got a dollar sign down here, and you write in a number. And then it's got a long line, you know, with the word dollar at the end of it, where you write out $9 and no cents. And then somewhere on here it says Union National Bank or Bank of America or Wells Fargo or Citicorp or something like that, and they got their name and address on there. Then there's a memo line. And see that memo? And it says shave, shampoo, haircut, and manicure. Shave, shampoo, haircut, and manicure. And it's got a signature line down there. Signature line where it's signed by Sam the banker. And then I want you to notice this long line of numbers. Starting in the lower left-hand corner, it's got funny symbols and numbers like 101 and 100540. And then it's got 0475, and then it's got 032, and then it's got 9409. It's got those funny numbers down there. Those numbers, to you, don't mean anything. But those numbers down there are very important numbers in what we call a guardian-ward relationship. Guardian-ward. If you can write that down, boys and girls, guardian and ward relation. Very important legal term. Now, there are consequences that come from these checks. Have you ever heard of people writing a bad check? And then have you heard of check fraud? And maybe overdraft? You know, kind of funny words like that. And have you heard of criminal penalties? Paper hangers? You know, these are all words that go along with these checks. Paper hangers, those are people that go around writing bad checks and taking goods and services from people, you know, and then the checks bounce. You get these things called bounce checks. Overdraft, that means that you wrote checks and you didn't have enough money in the bank to cover them. Sometimes when you write these checks, you'll get prosecuted for felony. It's a felony, you know, to write a bad check. And you could get prosecuted and put in prison for 5 years. Did you know that? Now, there's a contract that goes along with these checks. You don't just go into the bank and say, give me a checkbook. That isn't the way that works. You go into the bank and you say, I want to open a checking account. And they hand you a little card. And on that card, they want your name and address, and they want you to sign it. There's a signature line down there. And then in fine print at the very bottom of this signature card, they call it, the signature card, there's some fine print down there with some funny words. Fine print and funny words. Now, most of you people do not know what that fine print says because you do not have your special 10-power legalese reading glasses. You need 10-power legalese reading glasses to read these contracts because the bank is concerned about ecology. And they don't want to use too much paper because the more paper you use, the more trees you have to cut down. And so in order to minimize the amount of paper that they're going to use, they use very fine print. Isn't that just special? It's nice to know that insurance companies and banks are so concerned about cutting trees. That's why tree huggers all have checking accounts. Now, the truth of the matter is, the reason that it's in fine print is to discourage you from reading these words. And if you've just got 20/20 eyesight, you won't be able to read those words without your special 10 power legalese glasses, which I have right here on my desk. So I pull out my 10 power legalese glasses and I read the fine print. And that fine print down there says that I agree to be bound by the relevant banking laws of the state of Missouri and the United States of America, Title 31 and Title 12 of the U.S. Code, and relevant banking laws of the state. Period. I agree to that. Now, have any of you people ever read Title 31 or Title 12 of the banking code? Or have you ever read the banking code of your state, of Missouri or Florida or California? Well, normal people don't read those codes. They're public domain. They're right out there in the public domain. It's published in the Federal Register. It's published in the Congressional Record. It's published in the U.S. Code. It's published in Vernon's Annotated. And it's in every law school in America, and it's in every Supreme Court law library. Oh, you don't frequent the Supreme Court law library in your state. Well, just goes to show you what valuable material you're missing, valuable reading. You know, you people are reading Harlequin, and you could be reading Title 31 of the U.S. Code. Well, these banking acts over there regulate Bank of America. Tells them what they can do and what they can't do. And then you, as a customer of Bank of America, it ties you into the corporate capacity so that you can be treated as a corporation for the purposes of rules and regulations, customs, usages, and practices applied to banks through the statutes and court decisions and judgments. Yes, you too can be a banker. And so now all of these rules and regulations that you don't know about, haven't heard, couldn't find with a road map at high noon with directions, apply to you. You don't know what these laws are, but they apply to you. Oh, boy, if you knew what some of these laws... You know, when you people learn how to read, you're going to just be a terror, you know that? When you learn how to count and you learn how to read, you just... life turns on a dime. And I learned how to read when I was, or learned how to count when I was 37. I started learning how to read when I was about 43 or 4 here with A.J. Porth. And he pulled out the checkbook there, and he showed me these checks. And I asked him, I said, "Mr. Porth, do you have a checking account?" And he looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids. Of course, he hadn't given me the whole story yet, but, you know, he just kind of looked at me like, you know, "Son, you got to be kidding. Me? Have a checking account?" Well, I had a checking account. I was normal. You know, in 1983, I was still normal. I've become very unnormal, abnormal, extra normal, unusually abnormal since 1983 when I got this story on the checks. But Mr. Porth didn't have a checking account. And so I asked him, "Well, how do you pay your bills?" And he looked at me and he said, "What bills?" I said, well, how do you pay the power bill and the phone bill? And how do you pay for things?" And he says, "Well, I don't. I don't pay for anything. I just discharge my obligations. I don't pay for anything. I just discharge it." I'd been a businessman, you know, for many years. Discharge? What in the hell is this old man talking about? Doesn't have a checking account. Doesn't pay his bills. He discharges his bills. Well, I'd never heard this story before. "Well, say on here, Mr. Porth. Tell me more." And he said, "Well, Joe the barber now has to endorse the back of the check." And he endorsed the back of the check, and he gave it to Bill the supplier for a case of Wild Root Cream Oil. Bill the supplier gave it to Charlie the grocer, because Charlie the grocer gave Bill the supplier a case of ketchup. Well, Charlie the grocer gave it to his wife, who took it to Sally the beautician. Sally the beautician made Charlie's ugly wife beautiful at the beauty parlor, and Sally gave the check to Sally the beautician, who in turn gave it to Ron the Roto-Rooter man, who had to come out to clear the drain after Charlie's wife's hair plugged it up. Ron the Roto-Rooter man, he endorsed the back of the check. Now look at the back of the check. It's signed by Joe the Barber, Bill the Supplier, Charlie Grocer, Sally Beautician, Ron Roto-Rooter. And this goes on down the line. And let's suppose that this check circulates in our community. And it goes through 30 people. And everybody signs the back of the check. And there's an important proverb. And that is, a merchant's word is as good as gold. A merchant's word is as good as gold. So when a merchant signs his name, you don't actually get the gold because the gold is on deposit over in the bank. But you can go down to the bank and get gold anytime you want. And nobody wants gold because it's heavy and cumbersome. And it's subject to theft, whereas these pieces of paper aren't subject to theft. They're light and they're easy to pass around. And merchants don't steal. Merchants don't write bad checks. Merchants don't commit fraud. Merchants are honorable men. And a merchant's word is as good as gold. There's another proverb that says a free man's word is gold. You see, a free man deals in gold. A free man pays his bills with gold. A free man doesn't write checks. A free man's word is gold. A merchant's word is as good as gold, but a free man's word is gold. Mr. Porth explained that to me as he went down the list, and he said, now, it went down from Ron the Roto-Rooter man, to Harry the Hardware man, to Paul the Plumber, Earl the Electrician, Marvin the Mechanic, Otto the Office Supplier, Frank the Farmer, Jake the Janitor, Joe the Jeweler, Sam the Saddlemaker, Willie the Woodman, Bob the Rob the Roofer, and finally to Barney's Beanery. Now, Barney's Beanery passes the check over to you. Now, my name is George Gordon. I take the check. And I give Barney at Barney's Beanery a book for the $9 check. Now, I look on the back of the check, and there is no room on this check for me to sign my name and pass it on to somebody else. It's now filled from top to bottom with endorsees. Yeah, the people who endorse the check. This thing passes around just like a $20 bill. Well, you know, as long as everybody has confidence in Sam the banker. Now, of course, I don't have any place for me to sign the check, so I take the check down to the bank. And I walk up to the bank teller and I say, here, I've got this chosen action. Can you say chosen action, boys and girls? Chosen action. That's what this check is. It's a right of recovery. And I've got an investment of $9 in this check. And so I present it for payment. Now, the girl at the bank checks Sam's account and finds out that Sam closed his account 2 months ago and moved and left town. Comes back, hands me the check. And she says, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Gordon, but Sam the banker has closed his account. He doesn't have any money on deposit here. And we won't pay that check. Now, you can imagine how bitterly disappointed that I am when I go to cash this check and there's no money in the bank. This banker has written a check on insufficient funds. And a legal question arises. Who do I sue? Who should I sue at this juncture of time? Should I sue Joe the Barber, who is the first endorser on the check? Or should I sue Barney's Beanery? What's the pecking order? What does the law prescribe here? Well, at the common law, I would take it back to Barney's Beanery, demand payment, the whole $9. If I did, Barney could say, well, wait a minute. I'm not the only endorser on the check. There's 29 other people on there. You can't collect the whole $9 from me. You can only collect 30 cents from me. You got to go collect 30 cents from each one of the other 29 endorsers on the check. Or we could go to equity, and the equity judge would say, well, Jesus, not fair. It's not equitable for Barney to have to pay the whole $9. I could go to the common law, and then the common law would say, well, Barney has to pay the whole $9. Where should I go to collect my money? Equity or law? And how does the check work in 2006? Well, the answer is the check works in equity because it's an admiralty contract. And so we're going to go to admiralty. And admiralty has a set of rules. And then the rules say that everybody has to pay his fair share, because in an admiralty, what we're really talking about here is that Sam's ship sank, and with it, all of the cargo went to the bottom of the ocean. Now, what we're talking about is salvage. Is there any bottomry left on that ship? Can we salvage any of the cargo that's on the ship? So, salvage, bottomry, ship, admiralty, check, chosen action. These are admiralty terms. This is an admiralty action. Now, you know, about now you guys are sitting there saying, what in the hell have I got to do with admiralty? I just want to open a checking account and go pay my power bill, pay the telephone bill. Oh, boys and girls, you know, you didn't read the terms and conditions here that the legislature set down in Title 31, Title 12, and your State Banking Act. You didn't read the corporate charter of the institution that you're involved with here, that you're now a partner with, called Bank of America or Citicorp or somebody else. Now, next time we're going to talk about a story. A story about Harry Connick. Harry Connick. And the Circle K story. And I'll share with you some of these stories so that you can better understand. You know, Jesus spoke in parables. He was always talking about parables over here. The parable of this and the parable of that. Kind of to illustrate a couple of points. I kind of like to do the same thing, so that we can go through this step by step and understand what happened to us in 1933 with House Joint Resolution 192, which took away our gold. And why did government want to take our gold away from us anyway? What difference does it make whether you buy something with a gold coin, a silver coin, or a $50 Federal Reserve note? I mean, as long as you can walk out with the goods. Well, then, what's wrong with a credit card or online shopping or maybe direct deposit or automatic withdrawal? What's wrong with all of that? Sounds pretty convenient to me. We'll talk about that next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, as we're talking about the check story. All right, let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everyone, and good night, friends.